Ukraine accuses Russia of targeting rescue workers following deadly back-to-back missile strikes Monday night.
Firefighters sorted through the rubble and debris overnight, but had to stop over fear of what officials called a high threat of repeated shelling.
Plus, Donald Trump vows to keep talking about criminal cases despite prosecutors pushing for a protective order.
One of these lunatic reporters back there saying, "Sir, would like to talk to you about your case." Or, "I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to talk about it." Somehow that's not good for votes. Do you agree? When we say, "I can't talk," I'd love to, I will talk about it. I will. They're not taking away my First Amendment.
And U.S. concerns over hidden Chinese malware aimed at U.S. military operations. Today is Wednesday, August 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Ukrainian officials on Tuesday accused Kremlin forces of targeting rescue workers by hitting residential buildings with two consecutive missiles, the first one to draw crews to the scene and the second one to wound or kill them. Almond Lee with Reuters has details.
Ukraine says Russia missiles struck the eastern city of Pokrovsk on Monday night, killing at least seven people and injuring dozens more. Witnesses said two missiles hit the city center within 40 minutes of each other. Pictures released by Ukrainian officials showed apartment buildings badly damaged, as well as a popular hotel in the city center, one of the few still operating in the eastern Donetsk region. This woman was at home and thought she was spared when the first blast hit, but was not so lucky when the second attack came.
"And then that's it. Bang. And that's all. The flame filled up my eyes. I fell on the floor, on the ground. My eyes hurt a lot. Otherwise, I'm okay. Just a shrapnel in my neck."
This 75-year-old resident was also injured and had her home destroyed.
"I was talking on the phone, sitting, and then suddenly this flew out. And it fell, wrapping me up. Then the window fell on me. My back has cuts. I just got back from the hospital."
Firefighters sorted through the rubble and debris overnight, but had to stop over fear of what officials called a high threat of repeated shelling. Witnesses told a Reuters cameraman that responders to the first strike was killed and injured in the second strike.
That was Almond Lee with Reuters. Pokrovsk is located in the Donetsk region, which has been the scene of some of the most intense fighting since Russia launched its invasion in February of 2022. Ukraine's government says these latest attacks wounded at least 80 people. Washington is closely watching Niger's coup leaders after they chose not to meet a Sunday deadline to return the elected president to power, and after regional powers failed to act on their threat of military action. The U.S. has paused aid to the impoverished West African nation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington on what's next for Niger.
In Niger's capital, Niamey, supporters of Niger's military coup were defiant, despite warnings from regional leaders and the West, as junta leaders continue to hold the president captive more than a week after they seized power. Junta spokesman Colonel Major Amadou Abdourahmane.
"Le Conseil national pour la sauvegarde de la patrie met en garde."
The National Council for the Safeguard of the Country warns ECOWAS and the foreign powers against all interference in the internal affairs of Niger, as well as the disastrous consequences of this military adventure on the security of our sub-region, its stability, and the unity of our community. Sunday's deadline to return President Mohamed Bazoum to power came and went. From captivity, he managed to dictate an editorial to the Washington Post, in which he said the coup, led by the head of his presidential guard, has no justification whatsoever. The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, threatened to use force if Bazoum was not released. The body will now hold an emergency summit Thursday. Niger is a key U.S. security partner in the unstable Sahel region. A Monday Pentagon official said there was no change to the force posture of the hundreds of U.S. troops there, and no plans to evacuate them. Niger, one of the world's poorest countries, has the highest fertility rate in Africa and depends heavily on foreign aid. On Monday, the State Department discussed its decision to cut aid. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
"It's a significant amount. I don't have a number because it's a pause, and it's a pause that we would hope would be reversed if the junta leaders would step aside and restore constitutional order tomorrow. The pause would go away and security assistance would be reinstated, but as we've made clear, hundreds of millions of dollars are at stake."
But the junta leaders have some support, analysts say, as their counterparts in nearby Burkina Faso, Mali, and Guinea have come out on their side and held meetings with the Niamey group. Alex Fiennes has studied studied the continent for decades as head of the Africa program at think tank Chatham House. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
They're afraid of a regional economic community intervening and restoring democracy, and that's not what they stand for. I guess it shows how fearful they are that a values-based intervention that is a lot about preserving and supporting democratic process and accountable government is something that they don't welcome.
So with this testy region bristling with anti-Western vibes, what can the wider world do?
Any action by international partners, be they France or the United States, could be misinterpreted, misconstrued. So I think it is prudent of the Pentagon just to keep their people in place and kind of watch out as the mediation politics and possibly military intervention planning continues.
Meanwhile, in Niamey, residents have been stockpiling food and supplies for what could be a tense week ahead. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Campaigning in New Hampshire on Tuesday, former President Donald Trump railed against a series of indictments against him.
How can my corrupt political opponent, crooked Joe Biden, put me on trial during an election campaign that I'm winning by a lot, but forcing me nevertheless to spend time and money away from the campaign trail in order to fight bogus, made-up accusations and charges.
Trump also vowed to keep talking about the indictments, even as his attorneys clashed with prosecutors over a motion to stop Trump from sharing evidence in the case. Here are some of the other stories we are following from around the world. The United Nations on Tuesday welcomed news that Syria has agreed to keep two crossings open from Turkey to its rebel-held northwest for the delivery of aid for another 3 months. Bangladesh officials say the government will tone down its Digital Security Act to allow bail for suspects and stop jailing journalists for defamation. Journalists and rights activists have long demanded a repeal of the act to protect press freedom, calling it a draconian curb on dissent. And the World Meteorological Organization says the global average temperature for July 2023 is confirmed to be the highest on record for any month. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Earth's core is made up of two layers, its liquid outer core, made mostly of iron, and a solid sphere-shaped inner core. Many think the inner core has an absolutely smooth surface, but a new study led by researchers at the University of Utah suggests that it is scattered with iron grains as it expands into the outer core, giving it a kind of textured look. According to the study, these grains chronicle the growth of the inner core and may change over geologic time due to geodynamic forces. The study's authors made their findings by analyzing seismic wave data from nearly 2,500 earthquakes, all surpassing a magnitude of 5.7. The data was generated by the International Monitoring System, a global network of stations that is being set up to detect nuclear blasts. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. U.S. officials are looking for Chinese malware they suspect is hidden inside defense systems on military bases in the United States and around the world. I spoke with Professor Scott White, director of the cybersecurity program at George Washington University, for insight into why this is so concerning to the U.S. government.
The fear in the military is a cyber attack followed by a conventional attack. So if our adversaries were able to disrupt our cyber network inside the military, so our communications are down, our ability to launch or monitor an attack coming in, all of those things that we count on, if that goes down and then our adversary is able to launch a conventional attack against us, we would literally be ill-prepared to respond and defend against that. So anytime there's malicious coding that has the potential to disable our systems or interfere with the ability of our systems to respond to or acknowledge a potential threat, that places us at a severe disadvantage. The other aspect of that is it could be espionage, where lines of code are sitting in a system and that code that's been placed there, that malware, is able to exfiltrate top secret information about our readiness, our deployment of personnel, and so on. That type of espionage would also place us at a disadvantage.
And of course, there are also the concerns that if Chinese malware is infiltrating our military and other things like power grids, communication systems within the military, and also water supplies on military bases. That sounds like a big problem.
Absolutely. Anything, you know, any of that, the power grid, water systems, sewage systems, anything that's going to require facilities to allow our personnel to engage in the business of defense could place us at a disadvantage again if they were able to disrupt those sources. And throughout the United States, 90% of our critical infrastructure is in the hands of the private sector, not the government, as it is in all, you know, in Canada or other Western allies. So the onus is on the private sector also to maintain a hygienic computer system, you know, to protect us all. But, you know, the idea of cybersecurity supply chain is the real issue here. And cybersecurity supply chain means that we are dependent on the purchasing of technology and the global interconnectivity of that technology. And that places us always at a disadvantage, that we may purchase a piece of software or we may use a telecommunication system in a foreign country, that because we have to have global connectivity and because often we're purchasing software or hardware that's made outside of the United States, there is that ability for a foreign adversary like China to actually build in malware into at the construction stage of a piece of software or a piece of hardware.
If the government is actively pursuing the fact that they believe there is hidden Chinese malware that could interrupt American military operations, I would imagine they are working pretty hard to avoid all of the potential things you just talked about. Is that a difficult task, or if they already are aware of it, they must be on at least on the ball with this?
They would be aware. And, you know, we have a very robust cyber defense strategy. And we're also aligning ourselves with our NATO partners in our cyber defense strategy. So yes, there will be a lot of people continuously monitoring, auditing systems, preparing incident response plans for the advent that something does occur, but they'll be continuously searching those lines of coding to find any malicious malware and having it removed. But this is an ongoing issue, and it will continue. As technology continues to expand and our need for technology continues to be required, the future is going to be cybersecurity for all of us.
Professor Scott White, director of the Cybersecurity Program at George Washington University. UN agencies warn health conditions are deteriorating across Sudan and neighboring countries as growing numbers of people flee escalating violence between the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces. We hear more from Lisa Schlein, reporting for VOA from Geneva.
Before the conflict erupted on April 15th, 4.5 million Sudanese already were displaced, more than 3.7 million as displaced people inside Sudan, and another 800,000 as refugees in Chad, South Sudan, Egypt, and Ethiopia. Since the rival generals went to war, the UN Refugee Agency reports nearly an equal number, more than 4 million people, have become newly displaced. It says it is deeply worried about the health conditions in refugee and IDP camps inside Sudan, as well as among those arriving in neighboring countries. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler calls the situation inside Sudan untenable, with needs far outweighing available resources.
As many families have been on the move for weeks, with very little food and medicine, rising malnutrition rates, disease outbreaks, and related deaths continue to be observed. In addition, severe cholera and malaria are expected in the coming months due to flooding from the continuing rains and inadequate sanitation facilities.
The UNHCR reports there have been more than 300 deaths, mainly among children under 5 years, due to measles and malnutrition between May 15th and July 17th. It warns health services are being stretched thin for lack of funds, supplies, and chronic shortages in health staff. Now, in its fourth month of conflict, the World Health Organization reports Sudan's insecurity, as well as limited access to medicines, medical supplies, electricity, and water, pose a challenge to the delivery of health care. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer says attacks on health facilities are increasing. Between April 15th and July 31st, he says WHO has verified 53 attacks on health care, causing 11 deaths and 38 injuries.
Attacks on health care are a gross violation of international humanitarian law and the right to health. They must stop. Humanitarian workers need assurances of safety and security in order to continue delivering critical humanitarian and health response.
UNHCR and WHO warn the lives of many people are hanging by a thread. They are appealing for more donor support to save the lives that will be lost if that help is not forthcoming. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And turning the decades-long visions of Native American tribes and environmentalists into reality, U.S. President Joe Biden visited the state of Arizona on Tuesday, where he signed a national monument designation for the Greater Grand Canyon, citing the importance of preserving tribal heritage and addressing climate change.
Preserving these lands is good not only for Arizona, but for the planet. It's good for the economy. It's good for the soul of the nation. And I believe in my core, it's the right thing to do.
On the first stop of a three-day trip to three western states, Biden noted the designation will help preserve more than 1,500 square miles just to the north and south of Grand Canyon National Park. Meanwhile, U.S. Department of Interior officials are visiting Native American communities to learn about the impact of government-run residential schools on former students and their families. The institutions once suppressed Native cultures, but the few schools that remain now celebrate them. Mike O'Sullivan reports from Riverside, California.
Through much of the 19th and part of the 20th century, U.S. authorities forced many indigenous children into boarding schools, where they learned domestic and farming skills and were forced to abandon their religions, languages, and cultures. In Riverside, California, family members heard the stories of survivors at Sherman Indian High School, one of a handful of remaining government-funded boarding schools where today Native cultures are embraced instead of suppressed. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland and Assistant Secretary Brian Newland, both Native Americans, came to listen as part of the department's year-long tour called The Road to Healing. Curiosity brought one woman, Mavani Kalak Verdugo, belongs to the Rincon Band of Luiseno Indian.
I'm here because I wanted to see where my grandparents went to school, where they were taken, and also where my dad was born.
Her grandparents fell in love here, and her family adopted a strategy to fight prejudice.
They came out of the situation basically saying, well, the white man won the war, and maybe the only way to end discrimination for our kids would be education.
Some stories ended badly. About 60 former Sherman Indian High School students who died while attending the school are buried in a nearby cemetery. Victims through the years of disease or accidents. At some Indian schools, students were the victims of abuse. Erica Ben, a Navajo and more recent student here, says her time at the school expanded her horizons. She's working on a doctorate in the field of Native education.
I never really encountered anybody other than Navajos. So when I came here and the school was open to all students all across the nation, right? And that was my actual first time actually interacting with other Native tribes besides myself. And, you know, for me, that was an experience I'm not going to forget.
Greg Kalak of the Luiseno Indians sees renewed interest in the traditions among young people.
All four of my children are participating in the cultural things that our tribe is offering, including basket weaving, including language, beading, and such.
Like many Native Americans, they're re-embracing their culture and learning about a painful history of forced assimilation. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Riverside, California.
And watching the news of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, American comic book editor Scott Dunbier says he felt compelled to help. So he reached out to dozens of comic book professionals to create the anthology Comics for Ukraine, Sunflower Seeds, to raise funds for Ukrainians impacted by the war. Zhenya DeLo has this report.
American comic book writer and letterer John Layman contributed to the recently released benefit anthology, Comics for Ukraine, Sunflower Seeds. Here, Detective Tony Chu, a cop who solves crimes by receiving psychic impressions from food, saves a cat. While Layman says he drew his themes for this contribution from the current situation in Ukraine, he didn't want his overall story to be too dark.
basically, there's just a lesson here to help those who need it. I mean, that's, I didn't want to get too political. I don't want to take pot shots. I didn't want to have a bad guy. It's just a nice character piece. And it's a very, very sweet story, which, you know, for a book like this, I wanted to do something a little uplifting.
The 120-page anthology is made up of 15 stories created by more than 36 comic book writers, artists, colorists, letterers, designers, and editors. Some of the biggest names in the industry who volunteered their time and talent. The book is the brainchild of Scott Dumbier, an award-winning comic book editor. It was 18 months ago that Dumbier, who was watching the news coming out of Ukraine, felt compelled to do something.
There's a long history in comics of standing up for the underdog. I mean, that's really what comics are about, fighting for the underdog. And so that's what we're trying to do. And, you know, I wish this would be something that would make a huge difference.
Sales proceeds are going directly to Ukraine through Operation USA, an international relief agency, according to its president, Richard Walden.
In addition to money, we sent first aid supplies because they're training medics on the Poland side of the border. So initially, they were thought it would be combat medics. I said, come on, we're a charity. Don't make it combat. Just say medics. And wherever there's a need.
Comics for Ukraine, Sunflower Seeds, was released in July. A year ago, the project had already raised $100,000, Dumbier said. By the end of 2023, he hopes to be able to send an additional $100,000 to Ukraine. Jenny Adulo for VOA News, San Diego.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The World Health Assembly, the WHA, is the decision-making body of the World Health Organization, the WHO. It is scheduled to hold its annual meeting May 21st to 30th in Geneva. The stated mission of the WHO is health for all, and as Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a statement in advance of the event, the WHA's annual meeting is a unique opportunity for delegates and health experts from around the world to advance global health and global health security. Considering the meeting's purpose, Secretary Blinken strongly encouraged the WHO to invite Taiwan to participate as an observer at this year's WHA meeting, so it may lend its expertise to the discussions. Taiwan's expertise in the field of global health is indisputable, as are its technological capabilities, its democratic governance, its resilience in the face of COVID-19, and its robust economy, resources which could all beneficially inform the WHA's deliberations. In addition, inviting Taiwan as an observer would exemplify the WHO's commitment to an inclusive health-for-all approach to international health cooperation, said Secretary Blinken, noting that Taiwan has been invited to participate as an observer in previous WHA meetings. In fact, the WHO broke years of precedent in 2015 at the 70th World Health Assembly when it failed to invite a Taiwanese delegation to attend as an observer, a failure that has been maintained every year since then. Taiwan's isolation from the WHA, the preeminent global health forum, is unjustified and undermines the inclusive global public health cooperation and security which the world demands, said Secretary Blinken. Taiwan is a reliable partner, a vibrant democracy, and a force for good in the world, he declared. The United States will continue to advocate for Taiwan's return as an observer at the WHA and, moreover, for its meaningful and robust participation in appropriate international fora. Our support for Taiwan's participation in appropriate international fora, noted Secretary Blinken, is in line with our One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communiques, and the six assurances.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.